Welcome to another episode of Unprofessional. I'm Jamie Newberry, and across the United States of America, we have one Mr. Dave Wiskus.
Hello, Jamie.
Hey, Dave. How are you today?
I am excellent. How are you?
Fantastic. Back Yay. To fantastic. So
Good.
we have a guest today, and I bet you'd like to make an introduction of this guest.
Way to pass the responsibility off on me.
It's sharing responsibility, Dave. Not passing, sharing.
I guess. Our very special guest this week, the return of the magnificent, the lovable, the ineffable, Rene Ritchie.
Yay!
There is no way I can live up to that introduction, Dave.
I don't know that the introduction can live up to you. I cannot tell you how many times I've been in conversations with people where your name came up and the entire room turned to how great Rene Ritchie is.
Wow.
What a nice guy. What a
Glowing.
Friendly person.
Glowing.
Dave is the best thing ever happened to my self-esteem.
If you were an app, you'd be a solid average 5 stars.
Nice. I wouldn't get past review, but if I ever did, I'd get 5 stars.
Well said. Now, do you see why I share the responsibility of introduction, Dave?
Because I go so over the top?
No, because you make our guests feel delightful.
Oh.
Or at least Renee.
Yeah, just him. The others I make feel so-so.
just okay.
All right, so Renee, for those of our listeners who don't know you or did not listen to your previous episode on this show, which was entitled Bamf or Snicked, which I maintain might be the best episode title ever. Explain to the audience who you are.
I run a website focused on Apple called iMore, and I do a lot of podcasts, many of which Dave has been kind enough to grace.
This is far from our first podcast experience together.
Yeah, actually, you were kind enough to come on Vector last week.
Yeah, and this isn't even related to that. No. This wasn't like a washing each other's back sort of
thing.
There
was no quid pro quo.
It was so great to talk to you that when I realized that I had my wires crossed for the guest this week and we didn't have a guest this week, you were my emergency contact.
I molted you.
I thought, I need to get somebody on here. Who can I get last minute that I know will be good? And you were the first name I thought of.
I appreciate it. I'm sitting in a hotel room waiting for Macworld to start, so I was delighted to spend it in a fun conversation with you and Jamie. I apologize, Jamie. I'm going to call you Jamie a couple times because I really know you from that Twitter name.
That's all right. I am used to it. It works great. So
I always think of the Weezer song. And every time I say that, Jamie says, which Weezer song?
Which Weezer song, Dave?
The one entitled Jamie.
As well-versed in Weezer as I am.
The chorus is just him saying, well, the first two words of the chorus are Jamie, Jamie, which is why it gets stuck in my head. So look it up. I'll put it in the show notes.
I'll do it. All right.
They will cover it in a future episode.
We've not yet met in person that I know of, Renee.
I thought we had, but...
Uh-oh.
It's all right. It's all right.
I apologize. I feel dreadful now.
And I was going to say, I apologize if we have and I just have no memory. I've done that before and it's terribly embarrassing.
I don't know when you guys would have met.
I have never been to Singleton, so if that was the instance you were recalling, that was not
no.
me.
No. Well, Renee's usually there at Macworld.
And WWDC.
So there's that. And WWDC, but usually when I see Renee at those things, you're also there, but you're at different things.
Yeah, it's very possible that we cross paths or whatever at one of those, because I have been to a couple of those Macworlds and WWDCs, but... Anyway, we don't want to talk about work, though. We have more important things to talk about.
I do want to point out that it's interesting to note that Renee, I think, is the only person or one of only two or three people I know who are at Macworld this year.
I'm one of only two or three people I know that are at Macworld.
At Macworld. There are only two or three people there.
It turned into kind of a thing. I don't want to say ghost town because I'm sure it's doing just fine, but it's interesting that so many of our friends and colleagues decided not to go this year.
I think it might have been just a time schedule thing. I know I was bugging Guy English, mutual friend Guy English, about that, and he said, well, it's late in the year and I'm going there in June already for WWDC and I have UL and I have these other things planned.
Yeah.
So.
I was going to say, it is late in the year. Isn't it normally early in the year?
It's usually January or the first week of February.
That's what I thought.
But they've been moving it later on in the year. And it's mostly a big fan event now where they have people, members of the Apple community who come. So I don't know if it makes a difference to them in terms of the expo Yeah, probably the conference suffers for that, but I think
I'm sure the conference suffers because they can't get the same level of speakers that they used to be able to get in past years.
Like Steve Jobs introducing the original iPhone.
Well, no, I mean the conference part, even just like the technical talks or those sessions, a lot of the, I guess the Macworld staff people are still going to be there, right?
Yeah, and in some ways it's nice now because Apple cast such a big shadow over the show, and now all these little companies and interesting people have a chance to really show off their stuff instead of everyone just blowing past them for the Apple things.
Yeah. Now we're deep into dangerous levels of the talk show here, but so I apologize for that. But it's just interesting to me socially the way things have kind of shifted, and because there's so many conferences now, we pick and choose the big dots on the Pac-Man board rather than going to every little dot.
Also, I must say, Dave, without you being here, I have no idea what bars to go to at night now.
Aw, just stay in your room and drink out of the mini bar.
That's for later in the night. That's not how you start the night.
Okay, well, just as long as it ends with you drunk at the mini bar FaceTiming me.
Yes, I'll do that.
That'd be really
perfect.
Funny.
That's
all. Can that you matters. Record FaceTime? Is that? I don't think you can. We need an app for that.
Maybe you can pump it through Reflektor on your Mac and then screen capture that.
Well, there you go. Those would be hilarious. Drunken FaceTimes. FaceTimes from last night.
Why won't you answer?
Shit FaceTime.
Dave, there's an app idea worth millions right there.
I know. I was going to say, how do you turn like one night stand into FaceTime? Like,
wait, what?
Like a one night stand, but for FaceTime. Like, I'm trying to think of a name here, so I'm brainstorming out loud.
I thought you were saying that there was like already an app called
Horizon that I had not heard of. No.
Oh, okay.
I'm helping you here.
Yo, thanks.
It was probably Chat Roulette, but Apple banned it. They banned everything from.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Chat Roulette would have been banned?
It was on the App Store for like 10 minutes, wasn't it?
Really? Yeah. I did not know this.
Yeah. And then probably one of the Apple executives opened it. That was that.
Oh, no, no.
Oops. Yeah, it's on the springboard. It just says dicks.
That's very probably nice. A very Apple label.
We're way off track here. I don't know what happened to us.
Have you ever had to, I don't know. Yeah, I want to channel that away from the work topic, but have you ever had to, like review or analyze apps just for like research and discovery, sort of research and development sort of thing, that are things that you'd be embarrassed to have people see on your phone?
I have entire folders of things that I'd be embarrassed to have people see on my phone. I think maybe embarrassed is the wrong word because I'm me, but I think normal people would be embarrassed. I mean, I use the dating apps that people use, or I at least have them. So I guess mildly embarrassed, but not... I mean, I'll talk about it on a podcast.
So not that embarrassed.
Can't be that embarrassed.
I would like to download them and use them, but I haven't had time. We had somebody else actually download and review a ton of them last week for us. So I missed that opportunity, but I'm interested in looking at them. I wouldn't be embarrassed if they were there.
I was very against Tinder when it first came out because the idea of just looking at a picture and having no other context or information about a person seems like a poor way to judge whether or not you want to go out with them. Although I realize that's kind of what you do in a bar before you walk up and say hello. So you start a conversation, I guess, via Tinder. But now what I think is technology has made it so fast and easy to objectify other human beings. It's massively convenient. But no, I think it really is like what you would do in a bar simplified. So unlike something like an OkCupid or a Match or any of that shit, it's you like the picture, you say hi. And if the conversation turns into a good conversation, then you can go grab a drink or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think, you know, human senses do work at different ranges. You first see somebody before you talk to them, before there's any pheromones exchanging back and forth. You see somebody and that's going to be your preliminary judgment right there. And as much as they say, don't judge a book by the cover is on the outside. It's the first judgment you will always make.
Yeah, there's a reason they spend so much time and effort designing covers for books.
And the reason we have all these different industries towards personal grooming and clothing. And
it's funny you say that, the senses at different ranges, because it occurs to me that if the first thing you notice about somebody is the way they smell, then they're probably at one end of the spectrum or the other. It's going to be a really good smell or a really bad smell.
Yes.
You never say about a person, the first thing I noticed about him was he smelled average.
Or it would be something that you remembered, like it would be a smell that was significant to you for some point in your life, like, you know, one of your parents' colognes or an old boyfriend or girlfriend's colognes.
Yeah.
Something with a strong scent memory.
Yeah, and they say that scent has the strongest connection to memory, and we don't have a vocabulary for scent itself. So it stands to reason that you would only pick out a smell if it was either incredibly strong or evoked some memory for you.
And it's one of those things that Hollywood has not been able to replicate. Like, we have 3D movies and 7.1 surround sound, and smell-o-vision never took off. So it probably...
Well, that's true.
There have been companies that have tried. Like, the technology exists, but nobody wants it.
No, it should indicate how sort of primal, maybe, or important it is as a sense that we don't want it in our movies.
Well, we also don't get flavor.
That would be... I don't know how they would even... Smell, I understand.
It's just... I think that there's got to be a sense of accuracy to it, though, too. I mean, it's like if you guys been to, like, Disney, one of the Disney, they have the Flying Over California experience, which has, like, some fragrance that happens and some wind,
oranges.
Like, you know, breezes and stuff. Yeah, the oranges. And, you know, I mean, like, there's an accuracy there that's nice. But, like, then there's the pine tree part where it just kind of smells like one of those Christmas trees that you hang in your car.
Even the oranges smell like tang.
Yes, you know, so there's sort of a disconnect, and until that's perfected to a more natural sort of reality, it seems like, yeah, it's more of an impedance than, I don't like the smell of that little Christmas tree when I'm flying through California.
Well, they say, it's true that scent doesn't have its own vocabulary, and the thought, I guess, is that the reason it doesn't have its own vocabulary is because of how strongly it's tied to other senses. And so we describe it the way we would describe a flavor, or we describe it the way we see things, or we just compare it to the object. I think that maybe it's because scent is so complex compared to our other senses.
I had a colleague at my old job whose sense of smell was destroyed by working with chemicals so much. And he said it was a very strange existence. And he would literally pour cups full of ketchup on top of every food that he ate, trying to give it some sort of flavor, and it just totally wrecked his ability to enjoy those things.
Oh, that would be hell.
Yep. It would be. No sense of taste would be the worst.
Might as well be in the Matrix.
If you had to lose a sense, which sense would you give up?
I don't like this game.
Either. I guess
I don't
feeling,
want to listen.
Because I'm an artist, and I still want to taste things.
I know. I want to taste things. I want to smell things, and those are related. And then touch. Like, if you can't feel something with your, you know, touch, like, that's an amazing sense. And sight and hearing. Come
we
on.
Like them all.
Yeah, I want them all. All well, or nothing.
There's other human senses.
I'll give up my spider sense, Dave.
Empathy, balance.
Well, I'm
direction.
Thinking like your senses, like when we were talking
about the five primal senses.
Propriety. Right, I'll give up my sense of propriety.
I'll give it my sense of self-worth.
Done.
I'd probably go with taste. I'd probably give up taste. As long as I can still smell things.
I don't know. Why?
I don't like food that much. It's probably good for me. I'd probably eat better.
I was going to say most of us would probably eat a little better because it doesn't matter what you ate.
Or you could finally drink coffee, Dave.
Yeah. No, I would take the opportunity to start eating things that were way healthier since I wouldn't be able to tell the difference anyway.
Yeah.
At that point, it's just a series of textures going into my face.
Exactly. Ooh, it's so weird, though. And smells. Smells is still going to work.
Well, the texture thing is interesting because I can eat things like shrimp and lobster, but I don't like them because of the texture. And I think if the flavor was gone and all I had was textures, I might find foods that I don't enjoy. I might not eat as many foods because the texture would be so primal to the experience.
Yeah, it would be weird.
I do find that even now, some of the foods that I do enjoy, a big part of it is the texture. Maybe textures that I shouldn't enjoy. Like tapioca pudding.
Yeah, tapioca pudding's neat.
Or bubble tea.
I like it. Yeah, there's like stuff going on. I don't quite understand it, but it's fun.
It's good. I'm in on that one.
And not even in a gross way.
But that's like, it's interesting how powerful your brain is, because you can have that sensation of something, and then if it triggers the wrong thought, you'll almost start retching. If it triggers the right thought, it'll just go straight down.
Well, that's exactly my problem, where I can eat just about anything. The act of putting it into my body is not the part that freaks me out or grosses me out or puts me off to any foods. It's, I could be eating... I don't know, my favorite thing. Let's say the best hamburger I've ever had in my life. I could be halfway into the best hamburger I've ever had and see a spider across the room. I'm done. I can't eat. I'm put off to food.
So when I was a kid, my father took me, my father worked in a lot of Japanese companies, and we went to Asia a couple times. And my father ate very little because as a kid growing up in South Africa, he had farm animals in the backyard, and he made them into friends and into pets and eventually ended up on the dinner table. And it caused all sorts of, he just stopped eating everything at that point. And my sister's really similar, but when I was a little kid, and my father, he expressly wanted me to try everything because he didn't want me to end up like him. So I was being given things that I almost thought was horrific as a child, like, you know, like a whole shrimp on the plate and different kinds of flash fried fish and things. And I just learned to go into a fugue state where I don't even think about it. I would just eat stuff and try my best to be, you know, in my happy place at the same time.
Interesting.
Ugh.
Snake and stuff is interesting.
Yeah. I'm not going to do any of that. If I could, I mean, I could, and I've seriously considered vegetarian. I think I could do it. I would miss things, though. I'd miss a burger.
See, I know a lot. Actually, this is interesting. I know a lot of people who are vegetarian, but mostly to them, that just means sugar and carbohydrates. So it's like French fries and candy.
Yeah. All the, like, crappy fake food meats, too. Yeah. Have you? Yeah.
Like vegan pepperoni.
I know some of those people, too. Yeah. It's like, yeah.
There's a Thai restaurant here where the vegetarian menu said all meats prepared with tofu. Like, well, not really meats.
No.
I see what you're doing there, but I don't approve.
All meats are made from tofu. So there's no meat there. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a friend who works in a perinatal ward at a hospital, and she said it's not uncommon for women who are pregnant who've been vegetarians for a long time to just suddenly start craving burgers and steaks and things like that because their body tells them they need that sort of traditional protein.
Interesting.
I think because I keep having over and over the conversation about the things that I won't eat. People are always very interested in this. They're always trying to convert me or convince me that I've been thinking about things the wrong way.
Or how you like your steaks cooked.
At 32 years old, I just haven't thought about doing it a different way. Nobody else has ever tried to convince me. No, try fish. You'll be the one to talk me into it, I'm sure.
Try fish, Dave.
And it confuses me that people would be so interested or that they would care so much about whether or not I ate a fish.
I think it's just a difference. And people, one of the things about us is that we're incredibly tribal. And by tribal, it comes down to me versus you at the very end of the day. And anything that is different, we want to try to make the same.
Right, right. I'm thinking that maybe I'll just tell people I'm a vegetarian from now on. Because when you say vegetarian, they'll maybe ask one follow-up question, but that's pretty much going to be the end of it.
But then they'll try to feed you. Every time you go to a restaurant, Dave, is there a vegetarian option? Oh, look, Dave, you can have the sautéed peas. Oh, Dave, did you manage to find something to eat?
I get that now.
I always had the, people always assume I'm a vegetarian, though I'm not.
For some reason, I think of you as a vegetarian.
You know, somebody said this to me one time, because I made that comment. I was like, why does everybody think I'm a vegetarian all the time? And this woman said, it's because you're pale and thin. And I was like, oh, I guess that does it then. So I don't know. But yeah, I'm not, nor have I ever been. I did used to eat mostly vegetarian. You know what changed it for me, strangely? I went on a road trip one time and I tried the, this is disgusting and I'll acknowledge this up front, but it was 72-ounce steak challenge in Amarillo, Texas.
Nice.
Hot.
I did the challenge and I did not win the challenge, but I got 50 ounces down.
Holy shit.
And the sides, but you have to complete the whole thing to win.
Within an hour. You barely weigh 50 ounces.
Yeah, well, that steak was the size of my entire torso.
Wow.
But after that, this was several years ago. This was like 2008, I think, when I did that. And since then, I crave like a steak. I always want meat sometimes. And it's crazy. I never really liked meat much before that. I didn't oppose to it. I just never prepared it at home or anything like that. Now, like, yeah,
woke a
steak
hunger.
Is good. Yeah, it really did. It was crazy. Yeah.
I love a steak. So I could tell people I'm a vegetarian, and then when we go out to eat, I'll just order whatever I really want.
Vegetarian steak. So why do you have...
let them be confused.
Why do you have vegetarian projectionism, Jamie? What is it about you?
I don't know. I really don't know what it is.
I don't know if it... I mean, pale, thin, I guess. I think there's just a softness to you. Like there's a kindness.
A weakness?
No.
You're calling me weak, Dave.
I followed up soft with kind. Kindness. About you.
That squishiness? Is that what you meant? No, I'm kidding. I don't know.
It suggests that you wouldn't want to hurt anything, including animals.
An ethical nobility.
I don't know, but it's a,
Not that you're frail from not getting enough protein. I'm saying that you wouldn't want to hurt anything.
It's possible. I don't know. It is funny, though. Like, what does cause people to make such projections?
I don't know.
Do you guys do that to people? Do you go, well, he looks like a vegetarian or something like that? Do you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Or that girl must be, I bet she's a vegetarian. Do you have those dialogues?
I make my internal monologue is a real asshole. Like I make snap judgments or I categorize everything. And it's not because I see people as easily categorized. It's that I'm trying desperately to understand the world around me, especially other people.
Because you're not from here?
Sometimes it seems that way, yeah.
When he reports back to the mother planet, he wants to make sure he has an accurate assessment of humanity.
Well, sometimes I feel like a recovering sociopath just trying to integrate back into society.
Is that the good one? Because there's psychopath and sociopath, and I keep forgetting which is the good one.
I don't know if there's a good one, but there's a less bad psychopath. One.
Well, one's a killer and one's a CEO, right?
Psychopath is the killer. Okay. Sociopath is somebody who has no empathy.
Oh, nice.
Well, very you have nice. Tremendous empathy, Dave, because you care about the quality of things, and that usually means you care about the people who will end up using them.
Right. I'm just bad at thinking in those terms in the moment, I think, sometimes.
So in the abstract, you care about the empathy, but in the moment, you just want to...
Well, I can think a lot about these things later. So the way that I would judge somebody, like, oh, that person's obviously a vegetarian, or that person's obviously a sports fan, or I don't know, whatever it is. Later on, I will sit down and usually feel terrible about how the way I categorized them may have affected the way I treated them.
But is there?
And I have lots of little moments like this.
Yeah, you should feel like crap about that.
But you're not judgmental about it. You're just categorizing them. You're not an anti-vegetite or something.
No. And sometimes it's so the gym that I go to. I was walking out of the gym yesterday. And it occurred to me that I've never had really any interactions with the desk people other than, you know, when I walk in, that kind of like just a brief like glance. And I had checked in on Foursquare of all things. And one of the tips had commented that this particular gym was great because the staff was so friendly. And I'm like, I've never really known it. Like, I guess I've never really interacted with them at all. And so on my way out, I made it a point to take my earbuds out and say goodnight to the desk guy. And he looks at me. He looks up from his book when he hears me say goodnight, and his face lights up and he goes, "Have a great night."
Aww,
and
nice.
As I'm walking out, I'm thinking to myself, how many times did I walk past that guy and say nothing before that I could have just with that one by saying, "Have a good night," I could have been kinder. I could have treated him a little bit better. Or what was it that put me in that situation where I was, why did I think of him in a way that I could just walk past him like that?
That's one of my favorite things about you, Dave, is your self-reflection. And a lot of people say people can't change, but changing just takes work. It takes self-reflection and it takes analysis and it takes work. And you're one of those people that is willing to do it.
I don't know if I'm good at change. I'm good at acknowledging the things I suck at.
No, but that's the first step. Not to sound corny, but that really is. It's that you have to be aware before you can change anything, and then you choose whether you want to shift that or not. And it does take work.
Yeah. Well, now I'm making it a point. I haven't been since yesterday, but now whenever I go to the gym, when I walk out, I'm gonna make it a point to stop and say goodnight.
Goodnight, you vegetarian. Just keep walking.
And it does make me wonder, especially living in New York, I keep running into situations where the people that I end up hanging out with aren't necessarily from my industry, our industry. I was hanging out a couple nights ago with a bunch of comedians, and one of them was a writer for SNL. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what I would talk to these people about. And I felt like here's a moment where now I'm sort of the one who does the thing that nobody's ever heard of. And I was thinking about how I felt sort of being the odd man out in that social situation versus how other people might feel around me and my friends if they're not part of our thing. I don't know. It gave me a different perspective.
Interesting.
I'm learning. I'm trying to find ways to be better.
Building a better Dave.
As a human being.
That's, I mean, Dave, very much part of our history in getting acquainted is identifying a lot of those things that I don't know, we just kind of went through, you know, some of our friction points from the past, and we talked about them, and I don't know, I think that you've definitely, from my perspective, I think you've made some very positive changes just in the time that I've known you, and, you know, I'm not saying that I don't know what I'm saying. I'm saying I've noticed that.
She likes your new taste in co-hosts, is what she's saying.
I think what she's saying is, don't stop. You're not there yet.
Keep going.
It would be boring to be there, though.
Not fully baked. Oh, I hope I'm never there. I think I've said this on the show before. I hope I'm never there. I never want to feel like I'm done.
Yeah, no.
Or if I do, that's just before I die.
Yeah, that's now. See, I'm worried about finishing and dying, Dave. Thank you.
Well, I can't help you with that.
Not on the show, hopefully.
Other ratings would certainly be up.
Yeah, this is the episode where somebody dies.
Oh, man. Oh, don't do that, guys.
I like the comedian in New York thing, though. That mean, because you were in a very incestuous, not incestuous vibe, but you were, whenever I've seen you at least, you've been surrounded by people who do exactly what you do. And the idea of you being not only in a new city, but surrounded by entirely new and different people sounds really exciting.
I knew that I would never be better than what I was if I were always in situations where I felt like I was recognized. And it's really easy when you have that to end up getting to a place where you think of yourself as being a kind of celebrity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you go to a Macworld, you're surrounded, or you go to WWDC and you're walking around the streets of San Francisco and people recognize you on the street and look up and say things. There's exactly 1 week out of the year where that'll ever happen to me in one specific area and one specific city. But because of things like that, and most of my big social interactions are at things like conferences, it's really easy for me to like start buying into my own hype.
Yeah, to extrapolate that.
Yeah, and so the idea of living in San Francisco to me was really scary. I knew that would be very bad for me. I knew that it would be much healthier for me to be in a city where that was unlikely to happen, and I was far more likely to be surrounded by people who don't know me or do what I do.
The opposite of the Cheers song.
Yeah, I want to be where people don't know me, and I have to earn their respect.
You are not well known in Cirque du Soleil circles, Dave.
True. Maybe someday. Who knows?
Well, that's the exciting thing, is because you've attained a certain amount of success in your current field, but if, you know, there's so many other things that you could still achieve. I don't know what the right word for that is, but there's still a lot of things that you could accomplish, maybe.
Right. Me as a performer, as a musician, or as whatever other kind of performer I might someday want to be, it's healthy for me to get that range of experience and to meet those other people, make contacts, that kind of thing. But even less selfishly, it's good for me just as a person to be reminded what it's like to not be the popular guy at the lunch table. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if you never step away from your comfort zone, you're never really going to grow. So that's why I came to New York. That was the big reason why I came to New York. One of the big reasons I wanted to force myself to do things that I wouldn't otherwise do. And that's so much of my life is little hacks like that. For like putting myself into a situation where I have to do certain things. It's why I don't buy groceries, so that I will leave the house to get food. It's why I live in an apartment where it's more convenient for me to take the stairs than it is to take an elevator, so I end up taking more stairs, and that's healthier. Like lots of little things like that.
It's lifestyle hacking. It's forcing yourself to do. I don't know if it applies to social anxiety or not, but for me, I've always found when I started doing this line of work, I was not used to talking to people at all. It's just something I wasn't comfortable with, especially people I didn't know. But you sort of the same way you put yourself in that fugue state to eat strange foods. You sort of
absolutely.
Yeah, to talk to people and you just dive into the deep end.
Exactly, absolutely the same way. I don't know if I've ever said this on the show before, but when I was 18, I couldn't leave my apartment during the day because people would see me. So I had to take my trash out after midnight. Make sure that there's nobody out there to see me take the trash out. And I don't even know why. I was just super freaked out that people would see me. So my work schedule and everything was all set up to have as minimal human contact, as little human contact as possible. And now I say that, and I say to you that it surprises me that you would have ever had any trouble with that.
It's I don't know. I don't remember if you met Georgia or not. She came to Singleton for one day, but she's very good at this kind of stuff and dealing with social anxiety. And she has this thing where you describe it like a bubble. And the less you do, the smaller your bubble becomes. So for example, if it's driving, you might decide, I'm just not going to drive on highways anymore. And then it's not big streets. And then it's not suddenly any streets. Or I'm not going to go out. And then it's very easy to get to the point where your bubble is so small, you don't want to leave the house. So you've got to always force yourself to do exactly what you did, which is to do one step of discomfort and then another step of discomfort, because that's the only way to sort of break that pattern and be out in the world again.
Right. It should be a series of, and now I will.
Yes.
well, now I've done this, so I can not. I stopped doing this, and it's okay, so now I can do less, which I think is, at least for me, the natural inclination.
And it's easy. Like, I would go, the first couple of years I went to Macworld and WWDC, I didn't know anybody here. We used to cover smartphones, and Apple just didn't have any smartphones, so it was an entirely new community to me. And I would remember being in these massive rooms of developers or parties, and I didn't know anybody, and I would just be standing there, and then slowly, one by one, I started going up and talking to people, and that sort of broke me out of the rut.
It seems to have worked out okay for you
so far, but I mean, like all these things are different, and you probably, you know, you can know a few people, but then suddenly you're in a room with 100 people you don't know, or you could know those 100 people, but suddenly there's 1,000 people, or there's levels of people. Like, maybe, you know, I know the guy who developed this app, but and you know, I'm not sitting at the table talking baseball with Phil Schiller. So there's huge variances in your comfort level and the people that you know.
Right. And I think part of it, what makes it easy to do these things, to force myself into other situations, is because I know that I'll always have that safety net to go back to.
Yeah.
Or will you?
For the foreseeable future. Anyway.
Jamie, what do you know about Dave's safety net?
I don't know a lot, actually. No, I actually find it fascinating with our guests on Unprofessional, I think, are very telling in terms of repeat guests. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm saying repeat guests and within a same community for much of it. But there is a lot of branching out. And I think that's a good example of pushing outside some of those boundaries. It'd be very easy just to stick within the same small community all the time. But I love as much as I love the ones with the folks in the community, I love also the ones that reach really far outside the community. And when we talk to these people. But yeah, it's fascinating. I think it's a big thing for me as well. It's hard for me to break outside some of my norms as well and comfort zones. We all have those. But yeah, as far as Dave's,
For the show, the hope is that the audience wants to have a little bit of familiarity, I think. And it's good for people. I think some of the reason people tune in is to hear people that they have heard of talking about whatever random crap we're talking about that week. And so having somebody like Renee on, or when Guy was on, or, you know, a lot of these industry people, it's voices that are familiar because they hear these people on other podcasts, or they know them from Twitter or their work. And when we do pepper in the people from outside the community, I always feel like there's really two shows here. One is for our people, and one is for the rest of the world. And it's sometimes tough to make the decision of should it be one or the other. And I kind of think that what we're doing now is slowly introducing our community into the idea of an outside world.
I love it, though, because it also, I mean, even for within our community, it's a different side. Like, you know, to not talk about work, it brings out a different side of people's personality, which to me is a much more approachable side than sometimes the work side of people. So right.
We do it really deliberately. I don't know if it's deliberately the right word, but we were very conscientious with Debug too. We did a couple shows that people would have expected us to do, like the Lauren Brichter show, and but we also tried deliberately to get someone like a Jailbreak person on, and then we had people talk about NT or .NET, because we never wanted the audience to be comfortable. We wanted, or to try to peg us in might be a better thing. We didn't want to be typed as just one kind of show. So step by step, we'd do a panel, and then we'd do someone from a completely different background. And each time it sort of gave us permission to do something a little broader. And we're trying to, as much as possible, grow to as broad a show as we can step by step.
Yeah. And I've always felt that this show has had the potential to be a larger, more mass market thing. And I just, it's always the question, do we want it to be? Is it for us, or is it for everybody?
I've told that before. I think this is, like, to me, this is the, I don't know what the right analogy for this is either. I'm bad on analogies today, but, you know, almost like the Tonight Show for the internet generation. It's just a fantastic format, and probably has the biggest potential of any podcast I've heard.
What a nice thing to say.
Yeah, thank you. Well,
you guys do it. Just comment.
I think that's a great description of what I think of as being our audience, is internet people. And right now it's sort of like a segment of internet people, but I kind of want all of the internet people.
Yeah.
All of the internet.
Like Kevin Smith.
I mean, as a group, not every single one of them.
No, I don't like it.
Although I would be happy with that too.
It's one of those things where if you grow really fast, you feel like you've lost what makes it special. But if you grow too slowly, you sort of get stuck in a rut. So you want to manage the growth. And again, the same thing we went back to before. You want to grow that circle step by step so that it stays comfortable. You bring your... I have a background in marketing, so I apologize if I occasionally turn into
I want to hear
marketing.
Bring it.
I've also seen the numbers on your podcast. So please, how do you market a podcast? I'm dying to know.
Well, just in general... I like to bring an audience with me step by step. So whether it's when we've rebranded our site so many times, I don't change the logo. I want to always make sure that everyone is comfortable with step one before we go on to step two. The podcast thing is just nice because we have a huge built-in audience and we can bring them with us to new things. So it's really kind of a cheat. It's just we have a lot of people who read the website. So if I put a podcast on that website, I have a chance of bringing part of that audience with me. And it's the same thing I mentioned with Debug. We deliberately started with Lorne Brichter because we thought we'd get a lot of attention. And then we did Michael Jurwitz for the same reason, is that it would appeal to our base. And then we start carefully adding. I want to make it sound like we did it too. It wasn't that planned out because we had to get these people to agree to come on and we had to have some diversity. But we really wanted to make a show that we thought would appeal to the community at first. And then slowly expand it so that it's very similar to Apple. You know, you want to expand your addressable markets. You have a phone, one phone, you'll always only get part of the audience. If it's only available on AT&T, there'll be some people who just can't use it or won't use it. But when you add Verizon, then suddenly you have a greater addressable audience. And that's what we wanted to do, just add people that didn't change the tone or the feel of the show, but would maybe appeal. Like we had Casey Liss on to talk about .NET. And we had Mikel Diakaza on to talk about Mono. And that's a big divergence from our usual, you know, iPhone, iOS developer stuff.
We get commentary from people sometimes about, because the audience, as you might expect, is like primarily male nerds. And I don't mean that derisively. And I, as somebody who argues against the use of that word, I'll apologize for having said it. But you know what I mean. People who listen to the show will tell me that it's their wife or girlfriend's favorite podcast to listen to with them.
I totally get that.
And I see it too. I can see how, because we're not talking, it's if the guy in the relationship is really into this world and wants to listen to these people and is listening to this show, and it happens to be on when his wife's in the room, we're not talking about the work stuff. We're talking about people stuff. So I can see how it would appeal to both people in a relationship, even if one isn't necessarily steeped in this shit like we are.
I think that's great. I think that's the part that makes it accessible. And what I like about this show, too, and I got to stop saying nice things about this show, but I'm going to do it one more time.
No, don't stop. Don't
we like
stop.
It. We is like that, it.
No, but it really is. I'm a huge fan, and you know this, Dave. I'm a huge fan of DVD extras, of behind-the-scenes stuff. And this show is almost like the behind-the-scenes commentary track for people that I know on the internet and to some extent, you know, celebrities that I'm familiar with in general. I love that you get to peek behind the curtain and see what their interests are beyond the stuff that they just put up on the internet every day.
And sometimes we get extra layers of meta, and you can hear us talk to those people about this show.
Yeah, it's the hypercritical when Syracuse is critical of his own show episode every week. But no, that's the fascinating thing to me is that it puts the people behind the tech people, because often it's just the tech that has primacy. No matter what they're doing, they're always commenting on some aspect. And this is more about them, what they like, what they grew up with, what they do.
People.
We got to hear your Bane voice on an earlier episode, Dave.
Yeah, you have to go back and listen to that again.
It's worth it. So worth it.
So we had this text message conversation a couple of weeks ago, and it was born out of a conversation that me and some other people were having where your name came up and everybody started talking about how awesome you were. And the weird thing was that of the group, of all people who know you, I would say semi-well, people that would call you friend, we could not get consensus on whether or not you were married.
That is weird. I am not married.
And it was interesting to me that would... One, ever happen, that it could be a topic of discussion, but two, that I also didn't really know the answer to that question. I'm like, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that's the same thing, is that when you're in this bubble, we all talk about things that are not that related to our personal lives. Once in a while, you see someone will mention their spouse or significant other, but sometimes, and I didn't know if Guy was married for a long time either.
It's weird, and it got me thinking about how you typically only know, at least, and maybe it's like this for people in general, but I'm going to say within my circle of friends within this community, it seems to be that I only know details of people's personal lives if they're sort of forced upon me. meaning I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that if I know something, it's if I know they're married, it's because they mentioned their wife, or they brought their wife to a thing, or they brought their girlfriend to a thing.
Or you had their wife on the show. Or,
right. Very rarely do I say, oh, so are you married? Or you say, like, I would never say that. Like, that seems like a...
Overly personal sometimes.
Yeah, it's too familiar, and there's lots of opportunity to offend people.
I mean, I'm very deliberate about not being personal on the internet, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but I just always was raised, and I have friends who are very concerned about their privacy, so I always try to respect that by not talking about things in the real world unless they're really important. Like, I had my mom review the iPhone 5C for iMore, and I just loved that idea. Like, I would normally be very hesitant to that, but she liked it so much I wanted to get her point of view. But I think that's the first time I've mentioned my family. I mentioned them in passing on podcasts, but on a blog post. And I don't mention my friends' names. I don't mention my godchildren's names, because I think that kind of stuff, I got creeped out a couple times really early on in the internet, and it scared me enough to be really careful about it.
See, I had a different reaction. I always assume that people are going to know everything about me anyway, so I'm just going to be the one to tell them.
That's a little bit how I am. I mean, a little more on that side, but yeah.
I don't mind me. It's the other people that, like, I don't want to intrude on my friends' privacy.
Sure, but we've hit the point now where no matter where you shop, your credit card information is going to get stolen. I'm going to skip the middleman. I'm putting my credit card information in as my Twitter bio. Fuck it. Let's just get it over with. It's out there.
I'm checking my Twitter bio right now.
Gonna go shopping.
Good luck with that.
But I'm also very careful not to be political. Like, I don't state very many personal opinions on the internet, because I feel like people are following me sort of for...
This is why you're so likable.
You know what? I think there's something to that, though. I mean, I relate to that a lot, Renee. Like, I do post stuff, you know. Everybody, I think, knows, if you know anything about me, I have kids, I'm a single mom, like that whole thing. But, like, I don't post, like, political or any religious opinions or anything like that. Like, I'm very mindful not to do that. And it's, I don't know, I think it's just that is who I am, sort of, is mindful about those sorts of opinions. Interesting, though. Anyway.
Oh, I'm a goddamn loudmouth. I think I figured out why you're both so likable, and I have struggles with that.
Yeah, well, you're, like we talked about the other day, you have strong opinions that are loosely held. Like, I've seen you not change your opinions, but I've seen you evolve them considerably, even only the short amount of time I've known you.
Yeah. Well, I've certainly evolved some opinions. My opinions on guns, for example, have changed pretty dramatically over the last even 3 years.
There was this old Dennis Miller line back when he was still talented. Is that a bad thing to say? But see, there's an opinion. But he said that the one thing, I forget the context, it might have been about abortion or something, but he said that the one thing he hated more than any opinion on the matter was that other people felt like they had the right to dictate your opinion to you. And that's sort of how I feel. Like, I have opinions on them. They're not set in stone. I'm willing to learn them, but I don't like being told. It's like one of my pet peeves on Twitter is when people tell me what I can and can't tweet about. And it happens fairly often. I have to hold my tongue every time, because I don't care what you tweet about. You tweet about your stuff. I just want the ability to be able to express my opinion as well.
I get people, it tracks that I lose about half the people that follow me on Twitter in any given, I use this app called BirdBrain, which I love, made by Carl Von Rando, where it tracks over time who follows, who unfollows, and not because I care about how many people or anything, but I like stats, I like numbers, I like seeing things that are real, and I also like knowing when somebody that I care about unfollows me, because that's a type of feedback. If you're somebody that's I would consider a close friend and you stop following me on Twitter, did I say something? Did I do something? These are good things for me to know. But anyway, it shows you over periods of time, 1 week, 2 weeks, a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years. And it tracks that roughly for any period of time, the number of people who unfollowed me is about 50% of the people who followed me.
And those aren't just the bots?
No, it's everybody in general, as far as I can tell. Every account that followed or unfollowed. I don't think I got a lot of those. But it's interesting to me to think that my hypothesis, and I'm going off of sort of gut feeling and the types of people who unfollow and how long it takes usually to unfollow me. It seems like these are people who hear about me because of things that I've worked on, or because I was on a I was on Vector. I got a bunch of followers right after that, and then some, about half of them unfollowed me because I think they're expecting me to be the sort of person who's always tweeting about design.
Yeah,
they're expecting this thing from me, and when they don't, when they get me, you know, throwing out one-liners when I've had a couple of drinks at 2 a.m, that's not what they thought they were going to get.
They judged
you. I'm okay.
And they got something different.
Right. They were hoping to follow me for design tips or design opinions. Well, I've got a blog for some of that stuff, and I do talk about those things from time to time. But, man, the last thing I want to do on the internet is talk about my job all the time.
So you mentioned guns, which is interesting to me. Not guns specifically, but it occurs to me that a lot of the time my Canadian Quebecerness comes out. For example, our right-wing party in Quebec is the Liberal Party. That's as right-wing as you can get, because the other parties are all far more socialist than them. And you have the right to carry a gun in Quebec, but they've never issued the permit. They just put it on one desk, then on another desk, and you can go. So there's so many things about how I grew up that frames my understanding of the world. It just does not mesh with how it exists on Twitter, just in terms of diversity of opinion or preconceptions on what things might be.
Right. 140 characters is not nearly enough to cover this sort of stuff. And the 30 seconds I'm about to use to explain it isn't really enough time to get into this stuff. But it basically boils down to, I was very hyper-libertarian, pro-gun, and then there was just one too many shootings, and I had to take a step back and say, I am much more against murdering children than I am in favor of guns. And that, like, that one switch being flipped, I kind of look at the world in a different way, and I have to be pragmatic and say, In a utopian society where we could all behave, we could all have guns that we could, you know, have sitting around in case we someday felt like we needed them. But that's not what usually ends up happening.
My 2 cents, for whatever they're worth, and I say this as someone who spent years learning to fight with knives, and I did combat handgunning sort of Masad Ayoub style when I was younger. And well, that's a whole thing. Like, there's, I won't get into it, but there is combat handgunning and stuff. And I learned that not as a child, but in my teens and my 20s, I did personal protection training and a lot of self-defense stuff. And
you're hardcore.
I came to determine that, you know, guns are killing things. Like a knife, some of the best knife fighters I know are people who are trained in Chinese or other Asian restaurants, just because they learn to cut muscle and bone all day, every day. They're phenomenal. But those are tools that you can use, and one of the things you can use them for is killing, where a gun's only purpose is to kill. It has no other purpose.
See, I disagree. I do disagree on that point. The non-lethal purpose of a gun is sport.
Well, I guess target shooting, maybe.
Target shooting, trap shooting.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a far way to go. For like, you're representing the skill needed to kill something with that.
I don't know. The Olympics uses them.
Yeah, the biathlon.
There's Olympic events. There's like all sorts of. And I'm not saying that in and of itself is enough. But I'm going to say that just because we may not be into that sport does not reduce its legitimacy.
Sure. I worry more about like, I don't want to ever be someone's unintentional target. Like, so
of course.
It'd be a nice world if everyone had significant training who carried a gun. Like, if you passed a combat handgunning course, I'd feel much safer than just someone. You know, you have to get a license to ride a car, and I'm still scared of people on the streets.
Yeah. Before I would even purchase a gun, I made it a point to go and do training, like real training. And as soon as I did, as soon as I got my certification to show that I was confident with a handgun, then I was willing to purchase a gun. But I've been accidentally shot at by people who were supposed to be far better trained than I am. Ouch. Namely a police officer. The day that I was moving to New York City, I'm packing up the truck in Denver, and I'm about to close the door after I moved in the last piece of furniture, and shots are fired from across the street in my direction. By a police officer.
Ouch. Yeah, it's scary.
And these things, my stance on this had changed before I was accidentally shot at by a cop. But it's so nuanced, it's so delicate, and it's so complicated. But I have to err on the side of what's better for the humans.
Yeah.
Seeing as how I'm one of them.
Well, we've had significant, for Quebec, because we're not a very populous province, we've had 3 or 4 major school shootings, far beyond the amount that we should have per capita, and we also have really high gun control laws here. So it's an incredibly nuanced issue, incredibly hard. You can't uninvent things. You can't uninvent nuclear bombs. You can't uninvent hellfire systems on guns.
Right.
These things exist.
And what do you do? What do you do to foster intellectual, unpolitical conversation about what's good and what's bad? Because right now, at least in this country, we've got a real problem with, you can't talk about guns being bad without being labeled a liberal, and you can't talk about guns being good without being labeled a conservative. And either way, the other side sees you as a nut job. And so for somebody like me who sits in the middle, as like, I kind of optimistically would see it this way, but in the real world, it's more like this. There's no good way for me to be involved in a conversation about these issues at any real level without somebody attacking.
We're not mature enough as a species to have that discussion yet, at least not in North America. It's just there. Politics has been turned into such a sideshow, such a spectacle. And I think that in general, like, we have these elections almost at random where I live, and 90% of the time the civil service doesn't change. So the people who are actually running the province, there's no difference depending on who you vote for. But everyone gets so split up, and they get to control you almost by letting you think you have a choice. And I don't want to get paranoid about this, but it almost reminds me of the gladiatorial combat where political parties exist to distract and entertain people so that we don't pay too much attention to what's actually happening. So if you get really emotional about the gun issue, they can quietly do a lot of stuff in the background that you're not even paying attention to do.
Exactly. And the thing about guns or reproductive rights or healthcare, all of these things are things that we are not the entirety of the world's sample data. There are other countries who have done things differently than us, and we can look to them as examples of how things might work here, but we never do. We never look to other countries with regards to drug laws to see how things might work out. It's really easy to point to how things work in parts of Central or South America where things are very poorly maintained at a political level and say, well, their laws are like this, so that's a bad thing. But where it's more analogous to the U.S., a country like the Netherlands, which has legalized marijuana, they don't have a serious problem with it. But we never look at that in the arguments over drugs in our country. We never look at that data and try to learn anything from it.
Yeah, we program against the worst of us instead of trying to attain the best of us.
And then you see things like Colorado and Washington legalizing marijuana, and so far everything's okay. The world has not ended.
Then you ask them if they want to delegalize alcohol. You know, you might as well beat them in the head with a crowbar. We have such different perceptions on mind-altering substances.
Yeah, God has not struck down anybody over this whole marijuana. Well, other than maybe Fred Phelps.
it's just amazing. I mean, it's amazing to me when we put large groups of people, even small groups of people together, how rapidly we can lose our minds.
This is why I gravitate towards data. I gravitate towards things that I can understand. When it comes to the things that are difficult to understand, I want to watch YouTube videos that tell me what the science is so that I can know the science and not just have my opinion, but know to the best of our understanding what is actually happening. My favorite YouTube show right now is Healthcare Triage. Have you seen any of these? I keep linking to them on Twitter.
Have not.
But have you seen any of these? It's this doctor who spends a few minutes each episode talking about one healthcare-related thing. Like, the one this week was about, hey, let's stop talking about how milk does a body good and giving all this milk to our children, because it turns out it's really, really fucking bad for you. He doesn't drop the F-bomb, but he's very, like, impassioned. And he says, here's the breakdown. And he goes through it step by step. Here's all the studies that have been done. Here's what the data says, and here's what that data tells us. And here's why we can make this conclusion that it's okay to have some milk. Because I think he even says an Oreo without milk is practically a sin. But giving so much milk, giving the amounts of milk to your children that we do, is causing things like intestinal bleeding that can kill children because our bodies were not made to drink this stuff. One of the other ones he did was all about how sugar doesn't make kids hyper. And he goes through all the studies and he's like, look, I get it. You or somebody you know is a parent and you could swear that it does make your kid hyper. I'm telling you, it doesn't. And here's the science. Here's the data to back that up.
See, I
love stuff like that.
I was sent to an anti-sugar doctor as a child because my teacher swore it was making me hyper.
And do you have sugar now?
I try to eat as little refined stuff as I can. Like, I'm not crazy about it, but I do try to pick as natural stuff as I can now. So I have unrefined. Also, growing up in South Africa, you would get like a branch from a sugar cane and just chew on that. And that was the kind of sugar treat that you'd get. And here, everything is incredibly processed. So I try to stick with natural stuff if I can.
Actually, come to think of it, Healthcare Triage is why Faith doesn't talk to me anymore. I'm serious. I linked to an episode about, I think it was genetically modified foods.
Yeah, I mean, that always reminds me of that Jurassic Park line where he says, we're doing things so fast we never stop to see whether we should or not. And I'm not against it. I just think that, you know, a lot of the stuff we do so quickly that we don't have long-term studies on a lot of it. And I don't know that it's bad for me, but I'd like to have more data on it.
Yeah, I don't want to go down that path. It's going to get ugly. not for us, but it gets into ugly
like
stories.
Like Cosmos Ugly?
I don't think so.
I'm not
sure what you mean.
Well, that TV show, I just started watching it. That new TV show with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he's trying to show the virtues of science, and people are really upset at it.
Oh, yeah, freaking out over creationism.
It used to be on. That was like they brought it back. They brought it back.
Yeah, it used to be Carl Sagan, and now it's back with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
These people, man, these people who think that the Earth is 6,000 years old, they're the ones who scare me.
I have nothing against, I mean, if you look at human history as a tautology, there were people who believed in Odin and Thor and people who believed in Zeus and Heracles and people who believe very deeply in things. I just wish that you could believe deeply in your things while allowing everyone else to believe deeply in their things.
That's exactly my perspective. That is exactly, I don't think we have to, you know, have wars and shit over you know, your beliefs are wrong.
Like, Neil deGrasse Tyson is not picketing the Noah movie.
Exactly. He's just stating his case. Like, here's a perspective. Did you ever consider this? And, you know, yeah. Like, why can't we just have open dialogue? I mean, it really kind of harkens back to what you were saying, Dave. Like, if you believe one thing or another, people assume you're either, you know, really conservative or really liberal. And you can't just have a conversation sometimes about these things and say, like, well, here's a perspective. Did you ever consider this? Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I believe this. And, you know, can't we just have a healthy dialogue about it?
Speaking of picketing, Fred Phelps died recently.
Mm. Right.
A few days ago. Did anybody picket his funeral?
I hope not.
I didn't hear anything about this, so I'm assuming no.
No, that's... Yeah, if you can picket a funeral, the list of things that I would like you to do first is going to be extreme.
Yeah, his whole thing was picketing funerals of like, war veterans and things like that. With the God Hates Fag signs.
Oh, God.
The Westboro Baptist Church, like, that was the thing.
That I don't know about this makes me both happy and sad.
I know, I feel right there with you.
That explains the lack of reaction from you guys.
I thought he was an actor, Fred Phelps, I was just going to go with it.
No, Fred Phelps was a minister at Westboro Baptist Church, and his whole thing was was God Hates Fags. They've picketed everything from war hero funerals to San Diego Comic-Con.
And this is why you're such a likable guy, Renee.
So the thing is to me that if you feel that violently about something, you should really examine the root causes that may have nothing to do with it. That why you feel that way. Like, there's nothing that I would... There's nothing that I feel that violently about.
It seems like a waste of good energy to me.
It does. I mean, there's so many productive things you could do with that energy.
Right?
This guy he spent his life spreading hate.
Incredibly
sad.
Way to
go, guy.
My point was that it says something. I'm hoping that nobody picketed his funeral, because if it was picket free, that says something about how the other side of these issues felt about him.
People are damaged.
Yeah, don't even bother. Like, why waste the energy with that? Yeah.
Exactly. That's the point, that you're not going to see atheists out there picketing this guy's funeral.
Yeah, there are crazy people, and there are people who will follow them, and it's very sad. And I always think that people are, in some ways, the sum of their damage, and sometimes that damage is so severe that it just becomes toxic.
Well, you know who else was crazy and had people following him?
Who's that?